My name is Kalia, and I'm an alcoholic. This is an open meeting of the Atlantic Group of Alcoholics Anonymous, and all are welcome to attend. It is our belief that our meeting structure is necessary to maintain the integrity of the group so that it may better carry the message of AA, and since the most important aspect of AA recovery is one alcoholic relating to another, only alcoholics participate. If your primary problem is other than alcoholism, we think it would also be helpful for you to contact an anonymous organization, which more specifically deals with your addiction. Our literature persons, Phil and Dino, have the list of such groups. With their phone numbers in any case, we hope that you may learn what you learn here may be helpful to your recovery and understanding. Nina will read the preamble.
Hi, my name is Nina. I'm an alcoholic. Alcoholics Anonymous is a fellowship of men and women who share their experience, strength, and hope with each other so they may solve their common problem and help others to recover from alcoholism. The only requirement for membership is a desire to stop drinking. There are no dues or fees for AA membership. We are self-supporting through our own contributions. AA is not allied with any sect, denomination, politics, organization, or institution. Does not wish to engage in any controversy, neither endorses nor opposes any causes. Our primary purpose is to stay sober and help other alcoholics to achieve sobriety.
Please join me in the serenity prayer. God, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. Diana will read the steps.
Thank you. My name is Diana, and I'm an alcoholic. We admitted we were powerless over alcohol, that our lives had become unmanageable. Two, came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. Three, made a decision to turn our will and our lives over to the care of God as we understand him. Four, made a searching and fearless moral inventory of ourselves. Five, admitted to God, to ourselves, and to another human being the exact nature of our wrongs. Six, we're entirely ready to have God remove all these defects of character. Seven, humbly asked him to remove our shortcomings. Eight, made a list of all persons we had harmed and became willing to make amends to them all. Nine, made direct amends to such people wherever possible, except when to do so would injure them or others. 10, continued to take personal inventory, and when we were wrong, promptly admitted it. 11, sought through prayer and meditation to improve our conscious contact with God as we understood him, praying only for the knowledge of him, his will for us, and the power to carry that out. 12, having had a spiritual awakening as a result of these steps, we tried to carry this message to alcoholics and to practice these principles in all our affairs.
Zach will read the traditions.
Hello, my name is Zach. I'm an alcoholic. The 12 traditions. One, our common welfare should come first. Personal recovery depends upon AA unity. Two, for our group purpose, there is but one ultimate authority, a loving God as he may express himself in our group conscience. Our leaders are but trusted servants. They do not govern. Three, the only requirement for AA membership is a desire to stop drinking. Four, each group should be autonomous except in matters affecting other groups or AA as a whole. Five, each group has but one primary purpose, to carry its message to the alcoholic who still suffers. 6. An AA group ought never endorse, finance, or lend the AA name to any related facility or outside enterprise, lest problems of money, property, and prestige divert us from our primary purpose. 7. Every AA group ought to be fully self-supporting, declining outside contributions. 8. Alcoholics Anonymous should remain forever non-professional, but our service centers may employ special workers. 9. AA as such ought never be organized, but we may create service boards or committees directly responsible to those they serve. 10. Alcoholics Anonymous has no opinion on outside issues. Hence, the AA name ought never be drawn into public controversy. 11. Our public relations policy is based on attraction rather than promotion. We need always maintain personal anonymity at the level of press, radio, and films. 12. Anonymity is the spiritual foundation of all our traditions, ever reminding us to place principles before personalities.
The format of this meeting is 2 10-minute speakers followed by our information break, and then our main speaker who will speak for 30 minutes. Our first 10-minute speaker is Patrick.
Thank you. Hi, my name is Patrick. I'm an alcoholic. I've always known I was an alcoholic, mostly because when I was 5 years old, my mom told me. And I came from an alcoholic background, and I guess she saw the personality traits, and she told me that there's a 75% chance that you're going to be an alcoholic. And I didn't really know what that meant at the time, but I knew it wasn't good. So I grew up with a very real fear as a child that I was going to grow up to be an alcoholic, which I did not want to be. So when the rest of my friends started drinking at 10 and 11, you know, I remember the first time they came out with beer and we're hanging out in the park, right? They're handing out, like, you know, 12-ounce buds, and somebody gives me one, and it's real nonchalant, like we had been doing this the whole time, right? And I'm like, did I miss a memo? Like, I don't remember drinking beer yesterday. So, as people continued to drink, I actually didn't pick up till I was about 16 years old. And I had never drank enough to catch that buzz. But then once I actually did, like once I, you know, one night I was out with some friends and I drank enough to get the buzz, my whole life changed. I went from being the kid that doesn't drink to the kid that drinks all the time. At 16, I dropped out of Bronx High School of Science so I could pursue my career as a pizza delivery boy. Because that paid me money that would allow me to drink. And where was Bronx High School of Science going to lead me anyway? By the time I was 19 years old, I'll skip a lot of the drunk log, but by the time I was 19 years old, I was drinking every day, I wasn't working, I wasn't going to school, I was just running up bar tabs, and I was essentially, you know, living on my friends' floors and sleeping in the park. And, you know, I had because of a car accident I had gotten into when I was younger, I got a lot of money that I lent to my parents, and they couldn't use that money to buy a house. So they couldn't kick me out, which was, talk about a deal with the devil, because I would show up on a Tuesday night with like 10 drunken friends and we would just crash out in the basement and they would be trying to go to work. And that's the type of person that alcohol made me become. As bad as my drinking was, the bad part about my drinking was the hangovers. But for anybody else that lived in the Bronx around that time, the really bad part about my drinking was my behavior when I drank. I don't know whether it's because of the way I was brought up or just my alcoholic, you know, I need lots of attention, I want to be crazy type of behavior, but I would do anything, you know, to get attention. I was incapable of going home after being drunk and not hurling a garbage can through a window or a brick. You know, there was times where I would jump up on the hood of a car and just smash one windshield after another. So if anybody lived in the Bronx around the late 80s, I owe you an amends. Feel free to come up to me later. It started out as just like kind of fun. You know, we would go out and we'd bolt out on a taxi cab, or we'd bolt on a diner and not pay the check. And bolting on a taxi cab turned into getting into a fight with the taxi cab driver before we bolted, which turned into beating up the cab driver and taking the car and joyriding for the night before we bolted, using that car to smash up a bunch of other ones. You can't really live that lifestyle and get into fights every day without having some sort of consequences. When I was 19, my best friend was shot, went out and got drunk, and then got shot and killed buying dry goods. two other friends of mine who were in a fight, and they were both drunk out of their minds, were racing away, and my friend Frank put the car into a tree and decapitated his best friend. You know, and this was the type of stuff that we were doing up there in the Bronx, and we thought it was normal. We were in the hospital like three times a week. Somebody broke an arm, somebody's got their head stitched open, somebody got attacked by some other guys with machetes, and that's sort of the stuff we did. There was one night where I was out with my best friend, Whiskey Face O'Reilly, and we were probably on like a three-day bender. And we're the only ones in the bar at this point. You know how the bar's already empty and now it's daytime again and the sun's outside? And the only other person that comes into the bar is this woman who's like maybe 5 foot tall and 105 pounds. And she's drunk out of her mind, completely drunk out of her mind. So much so that the bartender wouldn't serve her. And just so you know, we were in a bar. I was a regular in this bar at 17 years old. So the standards for getting served in the Green Isle up in the Bronx aren't all that high. So she decides that the best way to convince the bartender to serve her is by grabbing everything she can get her hands on and whipping it at the bartender. Salt and pepper shakers, the ketchup bottle, whatever. I was playing pool with my friend Jimmy, and I had been losing to him all night, so I'm into him for like 200, 250 bucks. And she comes over and grabs the pool balls off the table and starts throwing them at the bartender. Now, I was winning this game, right? So this actually mattered to me. But so the bartender, myself, and Jimmy, we kind of grab her. We bring her over to the front door. We push her outside, and we're like, you seriously need to go home. You're a mess. Go home. So as we're walking back to the bar, she comes right back in, and she's got a little penknife. And she's squaring off against the three of us like we're in some sort of European women's prison movie. Like, and she's going to shank one of us. So, you know, we grab her again. We take the knife out of her hand. We pry the knife out of her fingers. We throw the knife out in the street. We kind of push her out the door again. We lock the door this time, and we're like, really, go home, and you're a mess. And as we go back to the bar, she puts her fist through the window and unlocks the door, cutting her hand to ribbons. Blood everywhere, right? So we rush over to the door because we're like, you know, we don't want this woman coming in again. It's already a problem. And as I rush up to the door, I've got the bartender on one side and my friend Jimmy on the other side. And she opens the door, and before anything happens, she reaches up and punches me right in the nose. I don't know if you ever got hit in the nose, but your eyes well up with tears no matter how, you know, hard or soft a hit is. And she hit me with the bloody stump fist, right? So I've got her blood all over my face as this is going on. Now, let me take a time out here and say, I have never in my life ever, well, given the way I grew up with the domestic violence and everything like that, I've never in my life laid a hand on a female. Nothing will make my blood boil more than seeing somebody hit a girl. So I've never hit a girl. Except her. And I wasn't trying to hurt her, all right? I just wanted her to calm down. I was drunk. So I slapped her. I thought this would calm her down. She stumbles back through the doorway of the bar, out into the sidewalk, laying out, falls down in the street. On the sidewalk. Bloody stump waving everywhere, blood pouring out. And now it's daylight, right? So there's kids on their way to school. People are opening up their stores. We come stumbling out of the bar. I've got her blood all over my face. I'm standing over her. And who's walking by at that particular moment but my mother? On her way with the little shopping cart to maybe go do my laundry or, I don't know, buy a grocer, who knows. And she looks down at the bloody stump woman and looks up at me and sees these two guys, and it looks like we've been beating the hell out of this woman in the bar. And she just looks into my eyes for like a second and kept walking. She never said a word about it. Which is, one, if you know my mother, she can't let a bad haircut or a t-shirt she doesn't like go by without making some sort of comment, right? She's from Clare. Which it's kind of appropriate because no words can convey the emotions that she sent to me when I looked into her eyes for those few seconds. The shame, the guilt, the fear of failure, you know, the thought that I had turned out like other members of my family. And I'd love to tell you that was my moment of, you know, clarity. That's where I sobered up. But I was only 17. I still had years of drinking to do, right? I guess I should fast forward. It wasn't until much later, a few years later, that I actually sobered up. And at 21, I actually gave up drinking. I don't want to get too much into that because I want to talk about my relapse. At 21, I gave up drinking. And let me tell you what happens when you stop drinking. You go from being the kid that steals cars and crashes them to I went to college, I became student body president, graduated valedictorian from community college, got a 4, which I know, being valedictorian at community college is like being the smartest kid with Down syndrome, but got a scholarship to a 4-year university, went to one of the best law schools in the country, got a series of jobs after that where I was making tons and tons of money. 16 years later, in 2005, I signed an employment contract. I made about $800,000. I owned 4 houses. I bought a Porsche, a Harley, and a condo on the beach in Miami in the same month when I signed that employment contract. And my life was going so well that I did what any good alcoholic would do, and I convinced myself that I wasn't an alcoholic, and I picked up. Wow, 1 minute. Dude, I'm rolling. Come on, man. All right. I spent the next 3 years wasting away all those assets, just, you know, essentially spending it all, having more or less nothing left. I haven't worked in like 3 years. But I guess I should, if you're new or if you're coming back, one of the other speakers are going to have something important to say to you. But if you've got some sobriety and you start going through a period where you feel like, you know, maybe you've got this beat, maybe you're not an alcoholic anymore, please come talk to me. Because really, no, you know, nothing can convey the agony and the pain that I put myself through, that, you know, picking up and what I've done to my life. I guess just before I go, one final thing. A year ago, I walked into the Thursday night meeting, and I was counting days, and I was terrified because I'd more or less been isolating for years and drinking, and I was in so much pain and so lonely and so afraid. And everybody went around, and they were introducing themselves, and I felt like they knew each other, you know? And it came to me, and I said, you know, my name's Patrick. I said my day count, and I was like, I don't know anybody. Can somebody please come talk to me? And the amount of support that I've gotten out of this group, I mean, little did I know that a year later, half of you would show up at my house last Saturday night. Right. So, thank you very much. I guess.
Our second 10-minute speaker is Doris.
Thank you. Hi, my name is Doris Vargas, and I am an alcoholic. Hi. I want to thank Debbie Y for asking me to speak. My stats are Susan S. is my sponsor. I got sober on March 1st, 2008, and Atlantic Group is my home group. So I am one of 5 children. I grew up in Rockland County, a little suburb up north, and I grew up with a father who drank a lot and was abusive at times. My mother left my father, packed up the kids, and left when I was 4 years old, and we moved into a shelter. And that was like heaven, you know. And we didn't have a lot of money, needless to say. So growing up in a little suburban, middle-class community, I felt pretty different. My first language was other than English. And I felt like on the outside, you know. But when I was 11, I found alcohol. And I remember drinking 3 beers and barfing into the white garbage can. And I'm thinking, this is cool, you know, because then I felt a part of, and I had this like false sense of confidence and security, and I felt sexy and courageous and friendly and funny, you know. And then through junior high, high school, college, I would drink and I would black out. And as time progressed, I would just continue to black out longer and longer. And I did a lot of shameful things, a lot of things that were just selfish and self-centered. I would race my SUV in California when I was drunk. I got handcuffed because I called some police officers some names that are not to be mentioned. I lied. I cheated. I was dishonest. And it just got worse. And there would be times that stop drinking. You know, like whatever I did the night before would be so shameful that I'm like, okay, I'm never going to drink again, you know? And that would last like 3 weeks or sometimes 4 months and sometimes 11 months, you know? But during that time, I wasn't sober. I was totally insane, you know? Restless, irritable, and discontent. And I would still lie, and I would still be totally inconsiderate. And I hurt people that I loved, my family and my friends, the people I worked for. And yeah, I felt small, you know? I was not sober. I just was not putting alcohol in my body. I still had a spiritual malady, you know? So fast forward to grad school. I continued to drink. You know, I remember one time I went into an alcoholics meeting because I was like, oh my gosh, I'm just having like, this is crazy. This has to stop. So I went to a meeting and there's a bunch of people smoking, talking about alcohol, but other substances too. And then I was like, oh, I don't really belong here because, you know, that's not my story. So then I didn't go back for 6 years. And through that time, I continued to hurt people a lot. Worse. My blackouts got longer, and I just kept going. I would just drink, and then total blackout. I just drank like every week, maybe every couple months, but when I drank, you know. I remember in January of 08, I did some shameful things on New Year's Eve. And so the next day, I was like, I'm never drinking again, you know? Come February, like end of February, I was in Baltimore on a conference, and I go to my friend's house, and she's like, hey, Doris, do you want something to drink? And I'm like, yeah. And she's like, water or beer? And I was like, oh, beer. Like, I don't even drink beer, okay? And she's like, I thought you weren't drinking. I'm like, I know, I wasn't. But, you know, because I felt uncomfortable. Like, I didn't know the people there at the party, and I just totally felt insecure. And I thought, why not? So one beer turned into a couple of shots, and then, like, four rum and cokes, you know? And then I blacked out. And I, in the middle of the night, I remember calling up my partner and saying, I'm so sorry, but, you know, I drank, and telling him my story of the evening. And he was like, oh my goodness, you know what? I can't talk to you. You know, I don't want to talk to you right now. So, thank you. I'm hanging up the phone. And at that moment I was like, oh no. And I thought, okay, something's got to give here. So the next day, this is what happened. The next day, he had to pick me up from the airport because I lived in Boulder, you know. And I was like, is he going to pick me up from the airport? So I called him in the morning. I called him like 100 times. He didn't answer the phone. But he finally answered the phone the next morning. And he was hurt, obviously, cold. Yeah, I'll pick you up. What time? I told him the time. Okay, goodbye. I'm like, I love you. No, like no response. And so he picks me up at the airport. And I remember being in the car. And it was like cold, like it was so tense. And all I could think of was like, oh my God. And I just started crying. And I was like, I have a problem with drinking and I need help, you know? And soon after, I was talking to my professor and at my school in Boulder. And he's like, you know what, Doris? I think you're an alcoholic. And I was like crying. And I was like, no, I knew you were going to say that. And so he said, you know, you should go to a meeting. And I was like, well, you know, I'm not really comfortable with going to meet with all those guys. And he's like, well, there are like all women meetings. I'm like, oh, there are? So that night, like, he told me his story, his whole story. And he was my professor, you know. He just totally broke his anonymity and told me everything that happened to him. And that just opened me up and was like, oh my goodness, I think you're right. I am an alcoholic. So that night I went to a meeting, and everyone welcomed me. You know, I felt so new and so scared, and But I knew it was going to be okay. You know, people were just like reaching out their hand, giving me brochures and phone numbers. And soon after that, I started looking for my sponsor. I wanted the perfect sponsor. And so I found a temporary sponsor. And her name was Christy, and she started walking me through the steps. And then I moved to New York, and she said, when you get to New York, you find a sponsor immediately. And I found one at the 79th Street Workshop. And I thought she was going to be my temporary sponsor, but thank God, she's my permanent sponsor. And, you know, Susan has walked me through the steps. I pray every day, every morning, and every night. And I know I'm getting a little nervous here, so I just have to, like, ask God to come in. Okay. Like working the steps, doing service, going to meetings, being of service, calling other people helps me, you know? I remember this March, I was going through a really hard time. I moved, I got a new job, I was grieving a loss, I was working the fourth step, and I turned a year sober. And so it was like a lot at once to hold. And I remember thinking, like, this is too much, you know, like, I don't know if AA is for me. I just got to go home, you know. But that, I took a week off. And that week was like the worst week. My life got smaller and I felt even more stressed. And I remember when I came back, like so many of you helped me, you know, my sponsor, my sober sister, Brooke. And many of you in this room totally reached out your hand, you know, like I needed help and you were so willing and you gave me direction. And I followed your direction. Thank you. And my life is so different, you know? Like, it was so unmanageable before. And now, it's manageable, you know? And, like, people used to say, oh, I'm happy, joyous, and free now. Like, now I know what they're talking about. You know what I mean? And for those who are new or who are coming back, you know, just, like, reach out for someone. Reach out to someone, you know? Ask for some help. Sometimes that's hard, but just like that willingness to reach out and ask for help because someone is going to help you no matter what. And I really want to thank you for my sobriety.
Our main speaker tonight is Jem.
Swinging from the fences at the Sirloin Saloon. That makes sense. I'm Jimmy. I'm an alcoholic. Grateful to be alive and sober. Grateful to be at the Atlantic Group in New York City. Safe, protected, in a place of neutrality. Thank you. I'd like to thank Heidi for the kind invitation to come here tonight. And it's a real pleasure to be here. I'd like to welcome all you newcomers, old-timers, retreads, everyone that's here tonight. Welcome back. And it's really good to see the old guard here, like Peg and Vince and Bonnie and Jimmy. And well, I saw Lisa around here somewhere before. But, you know, it's just a real pleasure to be up here tonight. Speaking to the mic. Okay. That just threw me off. My home group is a Design for Living group down in Wall Township, New Jersey, which is between Spring Lake and Belmar. We're a big book study group, and we meet on Sunday nights. If anyone's ever down on the Jersey Shore on a Sunday before you hit the traffic, come and see us, 7 o'clock. We're on the Internet, and we'd love to see you down there. I know a lot of people already from this group have been down there. My sobriety date, my day of grace when God entered my heart, my soul, my mind, was in Newark Airport. As I sat down with a new alcoholic friend that I just met at the moment. And for some reason, I just spit up my life story on this gentleman, not knowing what he was going to say to me, but I needed to just splurge my life that was going on. And he looked at me and he said, I have the answer for you. And he picked me up that night, and that was on March 28th, 1987, and I haven't had a drink since. And what he did was he brought me to the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, and he handed me over to you people. And my life hasn't been the same. I'm told that I'm supposed to share in a general way what it was like, what happened, and what I'm like today. What happened? Yeah, that's what I meant. And, you know, I like to start with what I'm like today. I'm not one to speak with jokes. I'm not one to speak with a lot of lines or any of that. I like to speak from my heart, the language of the heart. And I'd like to tell you about my day today. I was writing an inventory at 22 years without a drink. And the inventory that I was writing on was fear and resentment. And it's not fear that I'm here today. This is not a problem. It's in between the podiums that's the problem. But I was writing on my daughter today, who's 19 years old. It's not feeling good lately. And, you know, we're doing the old doctor treatment. You know, she's not feeling well, and we're not getting any answers. And I'm usually cool, calm, and collective under this, but I have an ex-wife who's kind of a hypochondriac, and I'm kind of feeding into that fear and thinking the worst of what's going on in her body. And so I needed to write some inventory today and talk to my sponsor about that. I also need to write about some resentments that are popping up lately. And I talk about this because there was a time in my life in sobriety that I would never do anything like that. I would come to a meeting and give you lip service that I did, but I would just push that stuff down and not talk about it and how it was bothering me. And my ego and pride wouldn't allow me to share that stuff because, you know, I'm sober this long now. You know, I should be able to handle this stuff, but slowly dying. You know, I'm going to share my experience tonight. So I'd like to start with an opinion. And the opinion is built out of a lot of experience with working with a lot of men. Now, I want you to really hear what I'm going to say. And what I'm going to say is that sometimes the newcomer isn't the most important person in this room. Sometimes that newcomer isn't the most important person in the room. And I'll tell you why I say that. And this group's a perfect example of that. Because what I see when I come here is that you guys grab that newcomer at that front door. And within a couple of weeks, you put a suit on him and you put a name tag on him. And you have him doing some sort of service at this front door. And he's working the counter, he's working the tapes, he's working the water, he's up here giving information out to you guys to what's going on in the city area in AA. And then I see him sitting in the back there with a guy called a sponsor, or a teacher over there, a woman over there. And you're taking him through our beloved big book, and you're giving this guy an opportunity to have an experience with God so he doesn't pick up that first drink ever again. And then a couple of months later, I come back and I see that newcomer, and he already has a few prospects under the belt, and he's sponsoring them. See, that's just like my home group and what we try to do, is to meet the newcomer at the door and let him know what he's up against and to offer him a solution and to show him what we need to do in order to get free. But see, the most important person in the room, I feel tonight, might be out there right now. And I don't know who you are. You might have 3 months. You might have 6 months. You might have a year, 5, 10, 15 years. You might be in double digits. And you're sitting out there tonight, and you're dying. You're dying of untreated alcoholism. But see, a little bit of time has come under your belt right now. And I'm not going to share that stuff because I'm 15, 22 years sober. You know, ego and pride has come back. And see, why I know this is just like me. And this is what exactly happened to me. And I sponsor a lot of men with a lot of time in this program who have fallen asleep in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. And then they hide behind the fact that they're 20 years, 30 years sober. They hide behind the fact that they're in service or they're doing something in Alcoholics Anonymous, but they haven't called their sponsor in 2 weeks. They haven't written any inventory in months. They're not talking about the resentments that are killing them slowly. And they're dying. So look around. Look to your left, look to your right, look in front of you, look behind you. Some of us are in serious, serious trouble. And if we don't put our hands up, or if we don't grab our sponsors, if we don't start talking to people about what's getting to us, these resentments, the fear, the guilt, the remorse, the inadequacy, you know, I'll leave it blank, you fill it in, we're going to pick up a drink. And I know for me, to drink is to die. Life and death. Sometimes we forget that behind the laughter. We had a guy down on Jersey Shore who was desperately trying to get this. And his wife found him hanging in a closet 2 weeks ago, 3 weeks ago, 23 years old. You know, and I know the seriousness, and I'm sure most of you guys know the seriousness of what we're up against here. I had my first drink when I was about 13 years old. And one thing before I go into a little story is, this is the third time I've spoken at the Atlantic Group. I really don't know why. Other than God, I guess. But I spoke when I had 10 years, on my 10-year anniversary on 95th Street. And I spoke here when I had 19 years on my 19th anniversary. And let me tell you about the pressure I felt on that 19th day anniversary. Because when I came in here, you guys just experienced the passing of a van. That was that day. And boy, did I feel pressure that day. But tonight, I feel good, and I'm good. Good to go. I pick up my first drink when I'm 13 years old, and as my sponsor says, little did I know, and eloquently puts it, I stepped on a road paved straight to hell. Because, you know, I was in a cemetery in Jersey City, and that's where I grew up, right across the river. And, you know, who knows what I was feeling as a 13-year-old kid, and I'm sure, like, all 13-year-old kids, you know, I have teenagers, too. And, you know, that insecurity, that, you know, fear, that whatever, you know. But I know I was with five of my buddies, and we went down to the cemetery, and we got the older guys in the courtyard to get us a drink. And I'll never forget it. It's 30-something years ago. And Colt 45 and Blackberry Brandy. And I remember drinking that and passing that around and, you know, puking purple for 2 weeks. And I could not wait to wait to do it again. The hook was in. The hook was in. See, Dr. Silkworth reads me like a book. I love the effect produced by alcohol. And that sensation was so elusive that I chased that for the next 16 years of my life. You know, and I'm not going to go into a whole bunch of war stories or anything like that. But I'll tell you, well, let's put it this way. Like Bill's story, you know, I drank for the fun of it, then for the necessity, and at the end for the oblivion. You know, I'm that guy that would take everything of value in my life, just like a lot of you guys out there tonight. I would take everything of value in my life, and I would put it right here. My relationships with my family, my kids, my wife, my job, my you name it. I would put it here, and I would take that drink with that foolish idea that somehow, some way, I could beat the game today. And I would buy into the lie that, you know, I could drink this successfully. And we all know that story. That when I put that first one down, that phenomenon of craving kicked off. And the most important drink always became the next drink. And I couldn't stop. And 16 years of that, you know, I got great stories. I got sad stories. I got good stories. I got beautiful stories. But my life was a roller coaster. And you never knew who was going to wake up that day, Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde. And, you know, the minute I started to put that drink in my system, and, you know, I became a morning drinker, I became a night drinker, I became an everyday drinker, you know, the progression went very quick in my life. And I didn't think there was anything wrong with me. And I definitely didn't think alcohol was the problem. It was you people. It was the job. It was my wife. It was my mom. It was my dad. I pointed the finger at everyone, and I couldn't get honest with anyone. You know, I got married during this period. I walked out of a marriage after 4 months. I'm an everyday drunk. I'm irresponsible. I don't care about other people. I'm really living like a pirate. And I really don't care about anyone. You know, and I really thought I was a nice guy. You know, and, you know, I walk out on this wife and, you know, I go into a 3-month binge of just constant drinking. The fear gripping me, waking up every morning facing those four horsemen, terror, bewilderment, frustration, despair, the feelings of hopelessness and helplessness that go with drinking. I couldn't find a way out until that day when I walked into Newark Airport looking for a job, because the guys at the bar told me they hire guys like me. And what they meant was a guy like me who can go and show up for one day at People's Express, which is now Continental. And what we used to do for cash is throw the luggage on the plane, and a lot of times we'd even make it to the plane, the luggage. So if you're looking for luggage, you know where. And but that's what my life came down to. Menial jobs, no education, no trade, no nothing. Really a sad case. And it's when I walked through that airport that day and I sat next to that man and I was shaking and I was baking. And I spit up my life story to him and he told me he had the answer. And he brought me to a room of Alcoholics Anonymous. And it was a catty corner from my house, or the house I was staying at. It was my grammar school. And I thought it was bingo going on all the time, but it was Meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous, you know? And I walked in there, it was like a grammar school reunion. I thought you died. I thought you were in jail. But I'm going to tell you something. That sense of comfortability of walking into a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous was what I needed. Just like you guys make us feel comfort when we walk in here and you extend the hand, our responsibility is to put that hand out. You know, and I'm up here with a couple of friends of mine and my wife. And, you know, every time we do come here, I love coming to this group for that sense of putting your hand out to us. And I think that's vital. I think that is so vital in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous because me and my wife, we also live down in Florida and we go all over the place. And, you know, there's times when I'll walk into a room and not one person will come up to me. Thank God I'm sane enough and secure enough not to take that stuff personal. But the guys I sponsor, when we meet on home group night, I don't let them sit around and talk. I don't think that's important right now. I think our job is to go out with all the halfway houses and all the young kids are coming in, or the old guys, whoever, to put your hand out and let them know we have a solution. You know, when I shared that the newcomer is not the most important person, that it might be someone in this room that has a little bit of time, I was 5 years without a drink and I wasn't doing absolutely nothing in rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous other than being in the fellowship. I was trying to get the benefit of three sides of the triangle by only working one side. I was in a fellowship, I was on, you know, a lot of activities and doing that kind of stuff, but God forbid I looked at Jimmy. See, I come from a place where, you know, real men don't cry. You know, real men go to work every day. I have a lot of old belief systems that were installed in me that were hard to break when I came to the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. And one of them was men don't share their secrets. Men just stuff that kind of stuff down. And see, 5 years without a drink in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, I'm psychotic. I'm crazy. I'm in a place where most people don't want to be in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, and it's probably the worst place that anyone right now tonight could be, and that's not drinking and not changing. And see, what happened to me was a man walked up to me after I gave a talk in Bayonne, New Jersey. And I gave this talk in Bayonne, New Jersey, and I lied from the podium for the whole 45 minutes because, see, I'm insecure, and I need you to like me. Because if you don't like me, then there's something wrong with me. And if something's wrong with me, I need a drink. And if I need a drink, I'm going to die. And if I'm going to die, there's no God. I'm all alone again. Self-reliance has failed me once again. So I'm talking about God on the second step in this meeting. And this man walks up to me. And he looks me eyeball to eyeball. And he comes up to me and goes, "You're screwed." In a little bit of saltier language. And that's where my journey of Alcoholics Anonymous starts right there. Because the old MO was to step back and hit the guy right in the head. But, you know, I looked at him and I saw something in this man's eyes. And what I saw was compassion. What I saw was dignity. What I saw was honesty. And what I saw was the truth. And what I saw was a man that was free. And what I saw was what I wanted. So I asked him to help me. And that starts my journey in Alcoholics Anonymous, 5 years separated from my last drink. And I sit at the kitchen table with the gentleman. I go through this beloved big book of ours. And I get free from the disease of alcoholism. I get recovered. The obsession has been lifted. And if I'm not drinking, the allergy can't go off. But I'm not a fool. I know the allergy is deep down within me. And I've been to enough meetings in 22 years to know that people that drink after a period of time leave off right where they will start, right where they left off, and sometimes worse. I'm so grateful for Alcoholics Anonymous. I couldn't stop drinking. I had nowhere to go. And the kindness of another man to sit me down and show me what I was up against. To show me how to write inventory. To get on my knees and make a decision. To show me the solution. To show me what these resentments, these fears, and this guilt, remorse, and shame associated with the harms I'm causing in my life and other people's lives is doing to me. How it's blocking me off from my solution, which is God. He told me, "Jim, if you can't control the starting and the stopping of your drinking, you're probably an alcoholic." that being a case you're suffering from an illness that only a spiritual experience will conquer. So 90 meetings in 90 days is a great suggestion, but that's not going to keep you sober. Sober softball is a great sport, but it's not going to keep you sober. You know, and I don't make fun of that stuff, and I appreciate the people that do that, and I've done that. But I had to get down to the causes and conditions of the things that were blocking me from God. See, the sunlight of the Spirit is real simple with me. It comes through these windows. You know, I'm sure on a Sunday afternoon, everyone sits in here, and the sun comes through in the stained glass, and that sunshine comes in, it feels good. Well, that's what my God is to me. But see, my glass, my windows are blocked. They're blocked with the resentments I have. They're blocked with the fear I have. They're blocked with the guilt and the remorse and the shame associated with everything I've ever done in my past. See, I'm guilt-ridden because I'm a criminal. I'm violent. I do things that I'm really not happy about, and I hurt other people. And see, in order for that sunlight to come through that mirror, that window, I needed to get rid of the things that were blocking it. And see, I was terrified because I would hear people say, don't do that inventory. You'll get drunk doing it. Wait a year. Wait 5 years. Wait, do a step a year and all that stuff we hear sometimes. And then I found out that the people that were saying that were people who weren't free. People who weren't doing this deal. People who were just talking out of ego. I don't take that personal. You only know what you know in these rooms. And thank God for good sponsorship. I took a fifth step, most important day of my life. I share about it all the time. Other than my two children being born, it was the most powerful experience I ever had in anything in my life. If you don't have a baby, or if you never saw a birth, you don't understand that. And most experiences, it's hard to explain an experience anyway. Those who've had them know what I'm talking about right now. But that day that I unleashed everything that was on my heart, my soul, my mind, to this gentleman, and I took that hour, a miracle happened. I felt the arms of God wrapped around me in that hour that we take. And I knew for the first time, at that time, 32 years of age, that I was going to be okay, that God was protecting me. I started to think less and less of myself, and I was starting to think more and more of you guys and how I could help yous. And how I could pass this on. A miracle we have here. And then I leapfrogged 6 and 7 because I didn't think they were for me because they were short and I need a lot of information to, you know, really get well. And I paid the price for that. I remember hearing an old timer say, most people don't start working a 6 and 7 step till they're 10 years sober. And I laughed at him. I said, you arrogant son of a... until I was 10 years sober and I understood. I have a friend that me and my wife run a retreat down on the Jersey Shore. We just had it 2 weeks ago. I can't see everyone in here. I'm sure some of you were down there. But it was a big book retreat, and we had one of the presenters was a good friend of ours from Colorado, by this guy by the name of Mickey. And he gave the best explanation of steps 6 and 7 I've ever heard. He said, imagine living this program without those two steps. Imagine going through inventory and a fifth step and unloading all this stuff, getting to the exact nature of your wrongs, and not having a place to take it. And I felt fear when he said that. You mean I have to fix this? I have to rely on self-reliance to get through this? Isn't that what self-help is all about? Isn't that what therapy is all about? What makes me not ready? What makes me not ready to let God have these things? Well, sometimes I blame my defects on others. Sometimes I justify and rationalize my defects. Sometimes I put those barriers up to, you know, in complete denial that I'm even angry as I'm punching walls. But I love to blame my defects on others. And see, after I took that fifth step and that stuff was very objectionable, what happens after a week, 2 months? 6 months later, is it still objectionable? And he talked about that seventh step, and he talked about a movie that I wasn't familiar with, but just listen to him talk about this movie, Joe and the Volcano. And I didn't know what the movie was, and I kind of, after he talked about it, I understood, but he talked about a part in that where Tom Hanks is, I think, on a boat in the ocean, and the moon comes up, and the moon is gigantic, and he says in the movie, I forgot how big you are. And he wasn't talking about the moon. He was talking about God. And see, I get this defects of character, and sometimes I forget how big God is in my life. I forget the things that God has done for me, what I couldn't do for myself. Sometimes I think that God's just going to take me to the end of the table and drop me. And my lack of faith, my agnosticism comes roaring out. And that's what I felt when I was writing Inventory Day, was that God wasn't going to work in this area to help my daughter and help me get through this fear. It was totally self-reliance. And what's that have to do with drinking? If you're new in here, everything. Because I have the kind of mind that needs ease and comfort from fear. I have the kind of mind that needs ease and comfort from depression and unhappiness and all those bedevilments on page 51, 52, whatever, I forgot. But you who have them know what I'm talking about. And it's a very important question we're asked. Either God is or he isn't. What's your choice to be? Ego says, of course God's everything. Then how come you feel the way you feel? Because I'm not letting go. I'm not trusting. And that's what gets me sick in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. Self-reliance. When I'm back to running the show again. Living in that delusion that if I just run your life, you everything's going to be wonderful. And nothing but nothing can stop that when I'm doing that but God. I lack the power to change who I am. That's my dilemma. My first step experience shows that I have no power, no choice, or no control in the mind prior to that first drink, and I have no power, choice, or control after I take that drink. I am powerless. My first step experience shows that I will drink again unless I tap into some sort of power. And for me, that is God. Lack of power is my dilemma. With power, no dilemma. I started to make amends. And I started to go through that process. And I'll tell you some unbelievable experiences out of doing a nine-step amends. And I'll just share a couple because I think they're real important. The first one was the one I finished yesterday. That's been going on for 7 years, and it was a financial amends. And I took a loan off a guy in AA because I had a quick-get-quick-rich scheme going on in my mind. And about 30 seconds after he wrote the check, the money was gone. That's how quick it went. And, you know, and so I had to pay him back, and I had to pay him back. And about 10 years ago, I was in a terrible accident. I got retired from my job and blah, blah, blah. And I was making my amends to this guy, but then when I got hurt, all sorts of fear cropped in again. And I wasn't paying him. I was going through divorce. I was going through all this physical stuff that I was going through after this accident. And yesterday I called him up. And I told him, I'm sending you the last check. And see, when all that stuff went on, fear kicked in and I stopped paying him. And I didn't call him. And fear cropped in again. Make the best possible arrangement possible. Make the best arrangement possible, as it tells us. We must face our creditors or we will drink again. And I knew this was another turning point in my life, that if I didn't face this amends and get this guy and get in touch with him and make a second amends on top of a first amends, that's horrible. That's horrible. Believe me. But today, I mean yesterday when I called him and he told me, Jim, you're a real gentleman. Out of all the people I've ever lent money to, you're the first man that ever paid me back. And I wasn't taken as a stroke of ego, but what I told them was, well, these are the principles that I was taught that I need to do and stay free. You know, it's this little stuff that we take for granted. You know, I got indicted on 2 counts of grand theft when I was sober a year, and I was terrified to face these amends, that judge, because I ripped off unemployment in New Jersey thinking that I could outfox a computer back in the 70s. And obviously, I got caught. And, you know, I'm no hero. I'm no, you know, it wasn't out of ego. But I stood in front of that judge. And I think we all face that time in sobriety when we're at the turning point. Either God is or he isn't. Can I abandon myself to this power and feel safe that I am going to get through whatever I'm getting through, no matter what's going in my life, no matter what, I can get through it. I can walk through that fire of fear, feel the uncomfortability, and stay sober and be free. And then pass that experience on to a new guy. And as I was sober and I was in front of that judge, you know, I was shaking, but I was willing to go to jail if I had to. because I knew that if I did not face my past was going to come and get me. I was convinced of that. And I got away, not away, I had to pay restitution, probation, but another example of trusting in his power. You know, I got amends like that up and down. I had so many amends to make when I first came sober, and still today. My sponsor said to me not too long ago, I'm done with all my amends. He said, Jim, I want you to start praying for the willingness to make the amends you're not aware of. And I'm like, ugh, what? Well, what's that? Where was that written? I didn't see that. This was on a Tuesday. Friday, I go on a retreat. And I'm in Madison, New Jersey, and this place has about 18 stairs. And I get to the bottom step, and I look up. Oh, not him. Not that guy. 18 years earlier, who I character assassinated and judged to death in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. And then I understood what my sponsor was saying. And I walked up those stairs, and I put out my hand, and I made the approach, and I made the amends, and he made amends to me, and we're good friends today, and we're free. There's nothing blocking. Prayer and meditation. Vital. Sought through prayer and meditation to prove what? This God consciousness. Rarely have we seen a person fail to attain God consciousness who has followed our path. Am I following a path? Every day's a day when we get to carry the vision of God's will into all our activities. How you looking with that? How you looking with that? The elimination of our drinking is just the beginning. A more important demonstration of our principles lies in our respective homes, our occupation, and in our affairs. How's that looking in your life? You know, am I the AA angel and then I walk out these doors and I'm a lunatic? Am I living a life of duality? Or is God right through my life? Is the principles of Alcoholics Anonymous throughout my life, in every area of my life? Important, important questions. And we do this for one reason and one reason only. For that guy who's going to walk through the great equalizer, those back doors. And to let him know he's home. And that we have a solution for him. And the solution is the action of those 12 steps, those 12 proposals. And we get him through those steps and we get him into recovery, we get him into the service, we get him into unity, we get him a part of. It's hard to stay sober on a one-legged stool. I need to be on all three sides of this triangle. And because of that, because of the men in my life, and because of the women in my life, because I've learned more from women, and I'm told to say goodbye, but I am eternally grateful for Alcoholics Anonymous and you people. Thank you.